You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We don't think about how technology can drive social change and even create politics that at times we're at each other's throats about, really. And when we do think about technology, then we're always thinking about, oh, social media or something with a computer. But technology in history takes many forms, and one of them is those long yellow vehicles we call school buses. You have a situation, 1946 to 1964, the baby boomer generation, a large increase in the population of young people in the United States. That means new school systems are being built. In some cases, students are going to be far away from walking distance. Fortunately, this baby boom arrives at a time when you have serious improvement in school transportation. In fact, there's a large conference that occurs in 1939 that starts to set standards for how we're going to transport pupils. You know, companies, even everything from the car companies like Ford to companies like International Harvester, are developing ways to improve the chassis and improve the length of vehicles so they can transport more students. And they're either adapting from truck designs or adapting from vans for smaller routes. But one thing that's agreed on in 1939 is the color, and that's simply called National School Bus Yellow. And the 1939 yellow is a little less bright than the yellow we see today, but it's designed so that in very early in the morning or late in the afternoon, especially in the winter months when, at least in the Northeast where I am, it starts to get dark, you can see those buses. During the 1950s and 1960s, smaller school buses are optimized for crowded, narrow streets. Chevrolet Suburbans are converted into small school vans, fitted with new red warning lights. In the 1960s, you start to develop safety features such as front and back cushions. So not just cushions where the pupil is sitting, but also in the front in case there's a crash. The seats are also elevated. This is the reason that you generally, with some exceptions, don't see seat belts on the long school buses because of the height of the seat and the cushioning. There's other safety features that come into play. You see in 1973 the development of the Wayne Corporation Lifeguard, a large school bus that's just a single body. So there's no joints because in accidents they were finding that these body joints were the problem for buses. You're going to see in the 1970s several U.S. standards developed. Bus exit emergency windows, bus body joint strength, school bus passenger seating and crash protection, fuel system integrity. The windows established in 73, the rest of them come in 1977. An interesting thing happens in New Jersey, because with the costs of the school bus systems going up and school systems looking for how they can economize and save, the state of New Jersey works with the IBM, which must have been a huge mainframe computer, to develop the best bus route for the burgeoning town of Toms River, New Jersey. Toms River is a town in what we'd say is South Jersey that kind of really grew from late 50s to 70s. Goes from 14,000 in 1960 to 41,000 in 1970. So you see a huge group of people moving down there from the northern part of the state. It had a fleet of 103 buses, and the computer reduced the time needed to plan the schedules from 4 weeks to just 3 days and saved the school district 2% of their usual costs. The program that the computer developed took into account variables including student locations, road types, known traffic bottlenecks, and intersections. So, you know, you have a school system with 150% population growth, and you're just using the computer to optimize the calculations of which route is best. Now, it's not AI. It's a little early for that. All of this technology comes to bear with the social change that's also going on, and that is the civil rights movement, the increasing realization that you can simply not have segregated schools, the command from the Supreme Court in the Brown versus Board of Ed decision, which in a lot of school districts means that the only way to make integration happen is going to be getting the fleet of school buses out and busing children from one school district to another. We always think about it in terms of the South, but the action in the late 60s and 1970s shifted a bit to northern cities. And when you look at Seattle, for instance, it was like Mississippi on Puget Sound. Segregation in schools was at a high percentage, and it was accepted to an extent because there was no law in Washington State or in Seattle, no ordinance that said black students must go to this school and white students to this school. It was de facto segregation. It was segregation that just happened because of what neighborhoods people lived in. 9 years after the Supreme Court issues Brown versus the Board of Ed, civil rights activists are looking at Seattle and saying this is exactly what that decision was about. And they launched demonstrations and lawsuits against the district. The district stretches it out, tries as long as possible not to make these changes. It takes a long time to persuade district leaders. In 63, after the first of three lawsuits filed by the NAACP, the district starts a small voluntary program. We'll allow you to transfer schools if you want. Very few people participate. 250 students took part. All but 17 of them were black. And the following year, on a budget of $800, Seattle CORE, the civil rights organization, assembles Freedom Schools, inspired by the same things that were going on in Mississippi. And there's a 2-day protest to publicize the program where 4,000 kids skip regular classes in Seattle, go to churches that are converted to makeshift classrooms. They're taught about civics. They make crafts. The students are fed. The school transfer program continues to grow. In a newspaper article years later, Michelle Osborne, who was one of the students whose parents volunteered her to go to a white school, Roosevelt School in Seattle, said that it was good. She got into a good cross-country track program, but there were still problems. She recalls how in 1975, in her senior year, with very good grades, a very smart student, Osborne discovers that her college counselor hadn't mailed any letters of recommendation to colleges where she had applied, costing her the opportunity to attend the school she wanted, UC Berkeley. When she asked why, the guidance counselor, an older white man, took a deep breath and said, "I didn't think you were college materials." So in 1978, the district launches mandatory busing. It's called the Seattle Plan. And for as long as they do it, there are protests in Seattle against it. Opponents slash bus tires. They take out ads in local newspapers. White families leave the district. Realtors are advertising to white families in King County, "Go where you can pick your own school." Thinly disguised racist arguments. In the 1980s, voters pass a state initiative in the state of Washington to legally stop the district from busing. And it was eventually struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Voters approve a citywide referendum to stop busing in Seattle in 1989, but that referendum doesn't lead to any action. In fact, the person who becomes mayor in Seattle in that year is the first African-American mayor in Seattle, Norman Rice. And he's getting elected at the same time there's an anti-busing referendum. And the events are not as crazy as that sounds. Even Norman Rice himself is not 100% in favor of the way Seattle's doing busing. I said, we're doing it because of court orders. We're doing it in a mechanized fashion. It's not being done with the student in mind. And there were some objections in the African-American community to busing going on. Busing's an enormously complicated issue. I talked about in the past about Claude Kirk, the governor of Florida, who was pretty good on civil rights issues until right about his reelection time, when then he was standing in the doorway and preventing the integration of a school. And it was, however, because of he was opposed to the busing of students. And at that time, he was seen as racist, and it contributed to his reelection loss. But over time, opposition to busing became different from opposition to integration. And of course, activists who were counter-activists who were against busing, you know, made that point clear. You have some comments from candidate Jimmy Carter in Georgia, where he's not favorable to the busing issue. And, you know, his comments would be more along the line of, why does the South just get punished and the North doesn't? We're going to talk about that, the reason why a lot of that happened, in a replay of a cast I have from 2007. Joe Biden gets caught up in this, and it comes up in the 2020 primary. And I just thought it was an interesting debate about a historical issue. Now it came out of politics. At that time, Kamala Harris was running against Joe Biden and wanted to bring up this issue to show him as archaic in his ideas, head fake towards, you know, painting Biden as a racist. But what killed that issue, in my opinion, is that they asked Harris, who was then a senator, what's your position on busing right today? And she, like almost every politician in America at this time, was not in favor of busing where it didn't exist, forced busing. And that was Joe Biden's position in 1979. So, in fact, he helped preserve at least court-ordered busing while being among the people who were against DOJ, Department of Justice, executive branch force busing. So it's an immensely complicated issue. One, so I said, you know, Claude Kirk in the early 70s is scolded for standing in the way, but that issue got more complicated over time. It was very common in the 1980s for large amounts of people to be against busing who otherwise weren't against civil rights. And that's what we're going to talk about today in a replay of a cast I did from 2007 about parents in the involved in the community versus Seattle, a court decision from 2007. And I did the cast as that decision was being unveiled. It was a decision of the Roberts Court. Hey, we're getting to the point of about 20 years of Roberts Court. The Roberts Court is longer already than the Warren Court. So this is a decision that, you know, has kind of stood the test of time. See, Seattle does eliminate their busing program in 1996 in favor of a choice program, so parents can choose their school. And so it's not forced, but obviously if people are picking schools, what's going to happen if a school's really good? And no matter what we do in these school districts, right, there's always the favorite school. So Seattle would say the tiebreaker goes to race. How diverse is that school? How much are we complying with integration? A parent, her name was Kathleen Bros, sued and said that race cannot be used. There are other plaintiffs. There's also a case in Louisville that gets attached to Kentucky that gets attached to this. And the court rules in 2007 in a decision by the court, but also an important concurrence from Anthony Kennedy that saved some place for race, but to not have it be the major factor. Somebody described it as the don't ask, don't tell for school integration. I'll discuss that case in a little bit. That case is now has some length. Seattle's diversity in its schools is actually in some ways worse than it was in the 1970s. And people have noted that and noted, but they are no longer able to use race in the way that they had been using. They had to stop the very next school year after the parents' decision because the plaintiffs in the case were going to sue again if Seattle tried to implement even for one more year the program that they had. Parents has not come up again. The Supreme Court has not ruled on a K-12 school matter. It has ruled recently on the use of affirmative action in higher education. But parents kind of laid the groundwork for that, and we saw a direction that this court was going with the little bit of a break that you had with Anthony Kennedy, who was a wild card. You know, it really depended on what he thought the effect of a various decision would be. He was a very effects-based legal analyst in his cases. One more case to talk about, and that is another Western case, and that's Berkeley, California. "I can still hear the sounds of the buses," said a woman who was interviewed in a newspaper recently, who's in third grade in 1968. Turbulent year in Berkeley. But Berkeley, being near the college, had a more liberal-minded attitude. That didn't mean things weren't contentious. But it had an area they called the Flats. And some of the people had moved during World War II when there was industry in the Berkeley area. And so it became a low-income and majority black neighborhood. And the schools look like they had been segregated, even though there was no law causing that to be. The Berkeley School District in 1968, early before a lot of others, sets up a busing system. Each bus is labeled with a color and an animal. There was one for the red rooster, another for a green duck. "238 black students were sent to white schools, and some white students were sent to South and West Berkeley for grades 4 to 6, and those would be African American schools. So the other day I had a very good turkey burger with jalapeno poppers, and I made it myself. Well, I opened the package from Factor, put it in the microwave, 2 minutes, and I had a delicious meal. It's also nutritious. It came along with a zucchini side. Loved it. 2 days ago, I opened another Factor meal, vegan mushroom marsala. Oh, almost like a risotto-type flavor with these excellent, well-seasoned mushrooms. Loved it. I'm eating healthier because of Factor. I think you can too. Ready-to-eat meals. You don't freeze them. They're not frozen. They're not made frozen. 35 options to choose from. You can pick calorie smart, protein plus, keto, or do what I did if you can't decide. Chef special. If you're still hungry, there are 60 add-ons to keep you fueled up and feeling good all day long. The best thing about Factor to me, compared to all these other meal plans that are out there, is that there's no cooking required. 2 minutes you're eating, and that's kind of what I need. No prep, no mess, nothing to clean up. And you know, but there's a lot of there's really not a lot of packaging. It's a very small package that it comes in. So head to factormeals.com/myhist50, M-Y-H-I-S-T, 50. Use code MYHIST50 to get 50% off. That's code MYHIST50 at factormeals.com/myhist50 to get 50% off.
Hello all, Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious Podcast here. Each week I interview an author or historian about a historical true crime, tragedy, or disaster. Subject matter ranges from gunslingers to Gilded Age murder to gangsters to fires to pirates to wild prison breaks. My guests bring their incredible knowledge directly to you. Please subscribe to Most Notorious on your favorite podcast app. Cheers, and have a safe tomorrow.
The pilot experiment was deemed a success. Neil Sullivan, who was the superintendent at the time, was very much for it. The school board was very much for it. They did a survey of schools in the 60s and found that this was something the statistics show they needed to do. That doesn't mean meetings weren't contentious. Doesn't mean there weren't protests. Sometimes in Berkeley, the meetings were contentious because they wanted them to do more. And even Sullivan points out that busing children, moving them from one place to another, sometimes then on their route, they would see nicer houses, other things, the way the other half lived. It accentuated the economic differences between those students and their classmates, between their own houses and the large, lush front yards they rode past. The facts of housing discrimination were engraved on their souls, said Neil Sullivan, the school district superintendent in 1968. They expand that pilot program to all the black elementary schools and to the white elementary schools, and they're busing an even amount of students all over. Busing was a bad word in Berkeley, just like everywhere else in the nation. Sullivan said there were 2,000 students that were pulled out of the school district. Either the parents moved or they moved them to neighborhoods and private schools. This is a factor. There are more parochial and private schools in the Northeast and the Northwest, the upper Midwest of the country. And that's why it's more of an option for parents to voluntarily pull out of these programs and experiments in cities in the 70s than it was down south, where there may only be one school. Anna Clark Foote, who was one of the Berkeley students, told a newspaper recently that the only differences on her mind, because she was seeing students of so many different races and colors, was between big kids and little kids. It didn't feel in any way uncomfortable or unnatural. The teachers would put on records at recess because the principal, Herb Wong, was a big fan of jazz, and a multicultural group of kids would dance their hearts out. To this day, Anna Foote says, I remember how great that was. Brandon Baum, who was from a white neighborhood in Berkeley, the positives vastly outweighed the negatives. It helped me connect more easily and readily with people of other races. Yet, I think I got into a fight every day that first week. There was definitely a racial component to it. I can imagine being an African-American kid in Berkeley, you're probably angry about the way things were, especially after Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Martin Luther King had specifically, before his death in 68, called out the Berkeley program as a model of what school systems should be doing. But the school system's population drops from 16,000 students to 9,000, 15 years after integration. Some of that is just people moving to suburbs, and some of it is because of the plan. And in 1995, the district ended it. They upended two-way busing and instead created three attendance zones. But instead of busing students, what they would try to do is make these attendance zones cut through lots of different types of neighborhood. So there's your school you're going to because it's somewhat close to you, but we're also going to pick up other neighborhoods. They designed it so that each elementary school was roughly 39% black. It's not possible to do this anymore, and that has to do with the decision that I'm going to talk about. I'm also going to talk about Brown versus the Board of Ed. This is a podcast from 2007. Hey, you listen to it. My thought on listening to it is, other than, you know, not having great microphones at that time, it holds up. I mean, I don't think much has changed. I told you about, we'll talk about the Seattle case, and I'll tell you like what happened afterwards. It's exactly what the Supreme Court dictated in that case has happened, and they had to revise their program. And there hasn't, and as I indicated, there hasn't been much discussion directly by the Supreme Court of K-12 schools since, although a few cases are pending. Here it goes. The Supreme Court ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, a ruling which ended segregation in schools in America, may not have ever happened had it not been for two heart attacks. The first was when Chief Justice Fred Vinson unexpectedly had a heart attack and died in 1953. Vinson was in the middle of dealing with a divided court facing its biggest challenge in recent years, how to handle school segregation in the midst of a series of five NAACP lawsuits in a variety of places, not just Topeka, Kansas, but also Delaware, Virginia, Washington, D.C., and South Carolina, but all consolidated under one claim, that of Oliver Brown, a Topeka, Kansas welder whose daughter Linda lived in a mixed-race neighborhood and wanted to go to school with her friends, not to mention go to the school that was six blocks away from her house instead of walking seven blocks to then get a bus to go to the school for blacks. The NAACP lawyers, headed up by Thurgood Marshall, who would end up on the court himself,
chose the Topeka system for the reason that it was not in the South, so it would look like they weren't singling out the South, and for the very reason that the Topeka system wasn't all that bad. The black schools were, as the court testimony would find, actually equal in quality to the white schools, and only the elementary schools were segregated. Integration already occurred in Topeka at the middle and high school levels. This differed from the Virginia or South Carolina cases, where the black schools were far inferior and all the schools were not integrated. By using Topeka, there could be no side discussion of quality. The court couldn't just rule the black schools are inferior, you need to bring them up to standard, and leave it at that. They had to confront the issue of whether the previous court doctrine, which held that as long as schools were equal, they could be separate, was well-founded. 50 years earlier, when a black man named Homer Plessy purposely sat down in the white section of a Louisiana railroad car and was fined $300, he sued, saying his 14th Amendment rights were violated. The 14th Amendment, of course, came after the Civil War, and the most important part holds that every citizen is equal under the law, the Equal Protection Clause. The court ruled against Plessy. In the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, instilled the legal doctrine of separate but equal, a doctrine that permitted most of the Jim Crow laws in the South to go on, and as a legal concept made separate black and white schools legal. By using Topeka as the lead case, NAACP lawyers were taking on Plessy directly. Chief Justice Vinson faced a court that was divided. It was made up of a group of New Dealers. FDR, with 16 years as president, appointed almost everyone on the court. A few were appointed by Truman. Felix Frankfurter, an Austrian immigrant who was Jewish, opposed school segregation and was sympathetic to the NAACP case, as was law professor William O. Douglas, who also had been appointed by FDR. But Justice Stanley Reed, a Kentucky Democrat, was opposed to overturning Plessy. Justice Hugo Black was a former Klan member, but he had voted in several cases for civil rights, while at the same time maintaining that the court should not be making laws, they should just be interpreting them. Robert Jackson was a bitter opponent of Hugo Black, had stopped talking to him, felt that he had been robbed of the Chief Justice's job by Black's treachery. Jackson was opposed to segregation in schools, and he was a liberal in some cases. He had wrote an opinion that it was not necessary and it could not be mandated to make someone salute the flag. But Jackson was sensitive to the impact of any decision on the South, and he felt that any court action might have an adverse effect on the progress that blacks were making. He felt that blacks made progress in the arts and sciences and were by their own actions, rather than the court's actions, proving that segregation was wrong. Now, in a lot of cases, that was used by proponents of segregation just to foster the system, but Robert Jackson was a very considered justice, and you sort of have to take him on his word on that. Harold Burton, the former popular mayor of Cleveland, and Sherman Minton, a former senator from Indiana, were anti-segregationists, but their votes weren't clear. Tom C. Clark personally wanted to end segregation, but he was a conservative, and he doubted the court had the power. He felt the court had made precedent with its 50 years of rulings on separate but equal. Chief Justice Vinson felt the vote might go 5-4, with Jackson, Clark, Reed, and perhaps Minton or Black voting no, and that such an important decision, a decision that would force all the schools in America to integrate, could not be taken seriously if it were passed by a bare majority. Vinson, former Kentucky congressman, himself was troubled by the role the court might take in deciding such a matter. He stalled for time. He asked for the case to be reheard, for the arguments to be remade, so that the court could examine the 14th Amendment on which civil rights rulings had been based. And in 1953, while this research was going on, and while Vinson was learning that the post-Civil War Congress that passed the 14th Amendment, you know, it also had stipulations that the U.S. government wouldn't pay for Confederate debt, and that Confederates couldn't serve in Congress, although that was later repealed, that this Congress that passed the 14th Amendment had little public schooling to regulate. There wasn't much public schooling in the country, and it didn't look good for getting a stronger majority than the 5-4. In the midst of this, Vinson had an unexpected heart attack and died. That was the first heart attack that helped along the Brown decision. Dwight D. Eisenhower was now president. He appointed Earl Warren, the governor of California, and a former tough-on-crime prosecutor who he felt would bring to the bench conservative values. The appointment was certainly inspired by political factors. Warren had not been a judge, but he had been the Republican vice presidential candidate in 1948 and lost a narrow election. He also ran for president, and he was a favorite son candidate in California in 1952, but he stood down for Eisenhower. That Warren was a politician rather than a judge was not all that surprising. Many of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal judges had been politicians. Certainly the majority of the court at the time had been former politicians. But Warren was an exceptional politician. He had run three times and won three times for governor of California, and he remains the only California governor to have done so. In 1946, he ran in the Republican, Democratic, and Progressive Party primaries and won all three party primaries. Thus, he faced no general election opponent in that year. He was popular and successful, setting policies leading to a boom in California generally and creating its university system. A man who had wielded executive power, Warren had no time for arguments about the limitations of the court's power or separation between the branches of government. His opinion was that once it had decided, the court could act. And this general philosophy of Earl Warren changed American law in the late 20th century. History likes heroes. And so in the Brown case, as we're starting to build up to here, this Warren court and Earl Warren is thought of as the hero, you know, standing alone in the crowd. But that's not really the right image. We have to put the Brown decision in a context that we often don't think of. Brown was not about a group of robed individuals sitting in a room deciding something that no one else agreed with. Brown represented a building change in American public opinion about segregation. Earl Warren's new Supreme Court was taking a stand, but not so much on a limb alone. Lower district courts had put the issue at the Supreme Court's door, issuing rulings that said only while the law stood, Plessy v. Ferguson was still the law of the land, separate but equal was still the law, but hinting that the Supreme Court could overturn it. And a Delaware judge, in one of the cases that would be commingled with the Brown case, said directly, "I believe segregation is unlawful, but I think the Supreme Court must be the one to overturn it." So lower courts were putting this at the Supreme Court's door. Another factor that impacted the decision that we don't hear a lot about in history is that the Eisenhower administration and its attorney general argued both for the reversal of Plessy versus Ferguson, the integration of the schools, and that it be done with all deliberate speed. Even the United Nations had weighed in against racial segregation in a 1950 decree, and that gave the integrated Soviet Union a propaganda advantage over the segregated United States and added an issue of anti-communism to the segregation battle. And there was also Supreme Court precedent. In two separate court decisions, Sweat versus Painter and McLaurin versus Oklahoma, the court had already cast doubt on separate but equal by insisting that black students be allowed to attend white schools and higher education where facilities were unequal. Would have been difficult for the court to find Brown any other way that it did given those precedents. But that context doesn't take away from the fact that Earl Warren quickly came to see the importance of the case, and as a master politician, quickly surmised, much as Vinston had, that politically the decision had to be unanimous. There could be not one dissent that could spark any hope of overturning that Southerners could use to delay the decision. After arguments were heard in the case, he used his deft political skills to convince the other judges. He refused to entertain old arguments about the court's power or precedent. Forget the 14th Amendment. Forget Plessy. Forget precedents. Segregation is wrong. We know it's wrong, and the court needs to make it right, he argued.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. we'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
He saw a new way to think about the court's power, which I believe was illuminating to some of the judges who were kind of on the fence about balance of power issues. And I believe a most important advantage is that Warren took leadership. He agreed to lead the charge. He agreed to author the opinion. He stuck himself out. In the end, the holdouts on the court seemed to be Justice Stanley Reed and Justice Robert Jackson. But Warren didn't want a 7-2 decision. Only a unanimous decision would send the right message, would lead to change in the school systems. And then came the second heart attack that would be crucial to the vote on Brown versus Board of Education. Justice Robert Jackson had a heart attack, though it was not fatal, and he went to a hospital to recover. And there, several times, Earl Warren went to see him and eventually got him to agree to go along with the decision. As Robert Jackson would die soon after the Brown decision, he didn't speak much about Brown, and no one's quite sure what Earl Warren said to convince Robert Jackson. We do know that he agreed to include in the decision some of Jackson's language about how blacks had advanced in art and science into the decision. But otherwise, we don't know what was said, whether it was Jackson's weakened state that led to him to be more agreeable, or whether it was he was actually convinced. We do know that despite his condition, Jackson did come to the Supreme Court building and appear the day of the decision. Once Justice Jackson's vote was in the bag, it was now 8-1, and Earl Warren moved on to Justice Stanley Reed, the Kentucky Democrat who had no interest in integrating schools. "Stanley," Earl Warren said, "you are all by yourself now. You've got to decide if that's really what's best for the country." Justice Reed never agreed with the Brown decision, but cajoled by Earl Warren, not wanting the spotlight on him, he agreed to go along with the others. And all of the justices, including Robert Jackson, sat as Earl Warren read a short decision that he himself authored, short enough, as Warren insisted, so that it could be printed in the newspapers in its entirety, that the Supreme Court of the land ordered schools to integrate. "Segregation of educational facilities is inherently unequal," the court found. Now, in 2007, there is no Earl Warren on the court. There's a new Chief Justice and a court that's divided. In parents involved in the community schools versus the School Board of Seattle, the Seattle school system used parental choice to determine where children would go to school. That was the first resort. But if the school was filled, the tiebreaker was racial. If the choice was between two students, the Seattle school board ordered that the racial makeup of the school would determine who got to go to that school. Whichever student best contributed to the racial makeup got entry. A similar system was used in Louisville, Kentucky, and the case was joined with this one. Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Antoine Scalia, Samuel Alito, as well as Clarence Thomas, thought the system of using race in decision about school attendance was completely unconstitutional. Roberts felt he was preserving the Brown decision. "The best way to end race discrimination in schools," the Chief Justice said, "is to end race discrimination in schools." Now, in an interesting event, Judge Anthony Kennedy, who was appointed by President Reagan, concurred with the plurality decision, but issued a separate concurrent decision in which he opined that the Chief Justice had gone too far. So he agreed with the majority that the system was unconstitutional, but he had a different reasoning. Now, in this, Kennedy becomes the third justice, and this becomes the third case involving race and education, Bakke, Grutter, and now Parents v. Seattle, where one single justice has a crucial decision that determines the court's opinion. In this case, Anthony Kennedy's opinion was that eliminating race altogether was going too far. There's still a role for race in education. Where Kennedy's decision is going to come to play, though, is in setting attendance zones or building new schools. He doesn't want the decision about any individual student to be based on race, only about students in the aggregate. Justices Breyer, Stevens, Ginsburg, and Souter dissented, with Breyer taking the unusual step of reading his dissent from the bench for 20 minutes, saying, "It's not so often in the law that so few have changed so much," and accusing the majority of misreading the Brown decision. Their strong dissent threw a spotlight on the fact that, unlike Earl Warren's court of 1954, this was a 5-4 decision, truly a 4-4-1 decision, and a far cry from the United Earl Warren court that in 1954 kept its differences quiet and issued its Brown decision unanimously. What's fascinating to me about the Parents v. Seattle decision is how much history plays a role. For Chief Justice Roberts, he drew a line from his decision directly back to Brown, and he said that he felt he was completely in compliance with Brown. Now, you can make a little bit of an argument here because Brown, in the end, was about a student who wanted to go to a school near their home. And so is the Parents v. Seattle case. He even read in his decision a statement from one of the lawyers that had argued Brown, one of the NAACP lawyers, that said that no state may make a law to use race as a factor in affording educational opportunities among its citizens. He may not have counted on the fact that the man who said that, Robert L. Carter, still alive, now 90 years old, said that his viewpoint was being stood on its head. The justices who dissented also used history, arguing that the case had overturned the settled law of Brown in cases afterward. I find this all fascinating from a historical point of view because it shows the uses and sometimes misuses of history. And one does have to be careful in the process of considering history to the events of today, especially doing something like a complete time warp from one historical event, the Brown decision, to another 50 years later, the Parents' decision, without consideration of the intervening events in between. It's a time warp that both sides may be guilty of. So did Parents involved in the community and Meredith versus Jefferson really overturn Brown? Not exactly. It's still illegal, obviously, in this country to have black and white schools separately. But that's a situation that really doesn't exist. What it does affect, however, is all of the remedies and all of the additional court cases that came after Brown. So to understand the Seattle and Louisville decisions, it's worthwhile to look at what happened. You cannot understand what happened between the two cases without thinking of at least eight other cases. Brown 2, Cooper, Green, Montgomery, Swan, Milliken, Bakke, and Grutter. And to look at what happened after that moment when the court handed down its unanimous Brown decision so you know where Parents fits in. After the Brown decision, per the Eisenhower Justice Department's instructions, the Supreme Court, again unanimous and again written by Earl Warren, said in what's called the Brown 2 decision that given that they've already found that segregation is illegal, school systems must now correct segregation with all deliberate speed. They meant that to be very fast. School systems, especially in the South, took that to be as soon as possible or extremely slow. And there was massive resistance in the South. Many refused to participate. In Louisiana, schools attempted to simply reorganize their public schools as private ones, so they didn't have to comply. That was invalidated by the Supreme Court in 1962 in Hall v. St. Helena Parish. Prince Edward County in Virginia, one of the original Brown cases, just closed its public schools entirely for 5 years until the court in Griffin v. Prince Edward County ordered them to open. And in Little Rock, Arkansas, when 9 black students tried to enter Little Rock High, it was necessary for President Eisenhower to send federal troops to escort the students and to restore order. After this, the Little Rock School Board, wanting to comply with the court's decision but under tremendous pressure, tried to get out of it. And they argued before the Supreme Court to attempt to get a 2-year delay to integrate. So in 1958, 4 years after the Brown decision, Earl Warren and again a unanimous court issues another opinion in Cooper versus Aaron, saying no, school systems cannot. Brown is the law of the land, and districts can't just ignore it. So now school systems were doing battle with district courts, and the reality is that in addition to many other historic rulings, Earl Warren spent all of his career on the Supreme Court, which would stretch from 1953 to 1969. He spent all of his career putting out fires related to Brown. In a 1968 decision, 14 years after Brown, in Green versus the County School Board, he said that schools could not comply with Brown simply by having a free choice system where students could go wherever they wanted to. It was their choice. And district courts read that to mean that there was going to have to be some forced integration between schools within a district. And in 1969, in U.S. versus Montgomery, the court upheld a district court's desegregation order, which insisted on a ratio of race for each school. These two decisions led to busing as a remedy. If schools were located in separate areas and needed to be integrated, busing became the only possibility to get students from one place to other, and many district courts were now ordering it. But it was not till 1971, 2 years after now, Earl Warren had retired, and Nixon appointed a new Chief Justice, Warren Burger, to the court, that the court faced the decision. It's probably more relevant to the parents involved in the Community versus Seattle decision, and that is the Swan versus the Charlotte Mecklenburg decision. The Charlotte Mecklenburg School District of North Carolina was segregated despite many court orders to change. The district court judge, who is an opponent of busing, ordered busing of black students into some of the white schools because he felt it was the only way he could comply with the Supreme Court's mandate. He wanted the population of each school to reflect 9-33% black versus white students. When the school system still didn't comply, the NAACP sued, and in another unanimous decision, the now Burger Court affirmed that district courts could order busing. But Chief Justice Burger was no Earl Warren. He was actually against busing, but he switched his opinion so that he would not be on the losing side of the issue and could write the opinion, an opinion which could limit the scope. And he attempted to severely limit the scope of what courts could order school systems to do until other justices protested. But in a sign of that dissent that was hidden in that decision, 3 years later, a more divided court would put a limit on the Swan decision, ruling in Milliken versus Bradley in 1974 that busing could not be used to bus students from Detroit into the suburbs. And that is where the court system, in effect, left Brown. Integration was now, from 1974 forward, for inside school districts only. That meant that while segregated districts still had to integrate by busing if necessary, the Brown decision could no longer be used as a mandate to totally integrate all education. Had to be within school districts only. This, among other factors, led to an increase in the so-called white flight, that is, the tendency of white families to leave the cities and move into the suburbs. And it also meant that the Brown decision would end up affecting the South far more than the North. That's the context we have to understand the parents involved in the community schools for Seattle School Board. Brown didn't integrate all the schools in the land. It simply made, after 2 decades, forced segregation impossible. After Milliken, school cases would not dominate the court's agenda, and by the 1970s, most school districts were in compliance with their inter-district plans. Then the battleground switched to higher education. When a Vietnam vet and a trained engineer named Alan Bakke came back from the war, and decided that, given his experience in the war, that he liked and would like to pursue medicine. Bakke was white, and he applied to the University of Davis Medical School. In 1973 and 1974, UC Davis Medical School used a system where there was a group of seats reserved for minority students, and for these seats there was a lower test score to be accepted. When Bakke was not accepted, and he learned of this system, he sued. And in the 1978 decision of Board of Regents of University of California versus Bakke, the court ordered the university to admit him. They found that a quota system employed by the school was wrong and violated Bakke's 14th Amendment rights, but they did not agree with what lower courts had said, that race could not be used at all in admissions decision. Bakke is an interesting decision because it was a plurality decision, not unlike the Parents versus Seattle. Four justices concurred, four justices dissented from the decision, and one justice, Lewis Powell, had a middle position. He decided to declare the medical school policy unconstitutional, thus he joined the majority, and he allowed entrance to Bakke. But then he decided to set up a constitutional test that the other four who made up the majority did not agree with, and actually the dissenters did, making it a very strange case. But Powell's test became officially the opinion of the court, because without his vote, the majority decision would not be the majority. That's similar to what's happening here in the Parents case with Anthony Kennedy. And interestingly enough, it is Kennedy who replaced Powell on the court. Powell's decision in Bakke said that scrutiny must be applied to any racial preference. It's okay to consider race among other factors, but the test has to serve a compelling interest. And that the interest can be, for example, in a segregated school system, correcting that segregation. It can be, for example, in a medical school for the purpose of employing doctors in a minority community. And another interest, the one that he held, is that it can increase diversity in the student body, which he saw as a positive goal. His concurrent opinion basically ended the use of quota systems that preserved affirmative action, not only in education, but in other areas. The next case to understand is Grutter versus Bollinger, and this is just recently from 2003. It is the Michigan University law case. In deciding whether to admit a student, the Michigan Law School considered GPA, LSAT, personal statements, letters, recommendations, and an essay in the admission. But another factor, in addition to those, was did the student increase diversity? The law school did not define that diversity as racial diversity, though the university had a policy of reaching a critical mass of racial diversity, though skillfully they did not define a number or a quota to this critical mass goal. A narrow court, with Sandra Day O'Connor as the deciding vote, upheld this program. Sandra Day O'Connor said that it fit with Powell's previous decision in the Bakke case, that the racial diversity standard fit a compelling government interest. She also added a time factor in this decision. There must be a time limit to race programs, and Michigan had said that they didn't plan to use race forever, and she took the Michigan University Law School at its word. With the Brown 2, Cooper, Green, Montgomery, Swan, Milliken, Bakke, and Grutter decisions now considered, the Parents' decision can be seen not as proponents or opponents of it would like to see it, as a direct line between the Parents' decision and the Brown decision, but as a zigzag between the decisions of a changing court with changing membership and opinions, and now, three times in a row, decisions based on one lone holdout justice. Looking at all these cases, the opinion of Chief Justice Roberts in the four-justice plurality to end all race consideration in education seems to be a bit hasty. At the same time, charges from the opponents that this decision overturns Brown tends to be blind to the history in this case and fails to see that a decision like Milliken effectively ended the thrust for integration by incentivizing white residents to leave mixed neighborhoods. And given that we are only talking about intra-city programs that can be integrated at all, most of America is no longer affected by Brown or this parent's decision, as most of America is in, as most of America lives in suburban areas. History doesn't always provide answers, but certainly adds perspective. After reviewing these cases, I can see that Sandra Day O'Connor in the Grutter decision did a service to the future of racial balance in education in her decision. And I would tend to agree with her take on how to handle the issue in the current time. It's her case that's been, and not Brown, that's been chipped away at and that saved Kennedy's concurrent position, would have been wiped out by the Parents versus Seattle decision. Like Sandra Day O'Connor, I see that there must be a point at which racial consideration in education ends. Though 2007 may be too early, especially considering with A school system like the Louisville school system was declared officially integrated in 2000. But there does have to be a point at which race consideration in education ends. But to this end, though, when you look at the history of cases since Brown, you can see clearly that the court itself will change and adapt to the times, and probably at some point in the future will provide this timeout. Or in a future decision, the Supreme Court could actually order school systems to have a mandated date or year when the racial consideration ends. That might have been a better way to handle this case. I see merit in the Kennedy concurrent opinion. I think others will. And remember, any challenge now that comes to the court again involving this parent's case will essentially be a petitioner arguing to Kennedy, unless there's another change in the court. So with Kennedy's concurrence, race can still be used in attendance zones. Though there's still problems with that. If the problem that's the school is lopsided by race, how do you make an attendance zone that integrates? If a school has a kind of a spaghetti-shaped attendance zone, we may see that issue come before the court in the future, and then we're going to see what Kennedy's opinion on that actually is. But I hope this has been a useful survey of where we've been from Brown to parents and what's in between, and with history beating up politics, I'm Bruce Carlson.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.